Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, everyone. A good afternoon and good evening to others as well. My name is Shiv, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awaken call. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversation with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest speaker is none other than Yoav Beck, and someone who really embodies today's theme of encountering others in their full humanity. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us. And today, my name is Shiv, and today in our conversation with Yoav Beck and R.E.A. Smith in today's Awaken call, we will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A, a question and answer, and circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. I have opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit *6. That would be *6 on your phone, and you will be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicespace.org. That would be ask@servicespace.org. This week's theme, as I shared earlier, is encountering others in their full humanity. Now, our guest this week creates opportunities for face-to-face meetings among people across deep cultural, social, and political divides. For a person like me, we need to hear stories like these because today, more than ever, it's so important to not just meet people, to not just encounter people, but to encounter them in their full humanity. So I'm really looking forward to hearing the conversation today. We also have the pleasure of having a remarkable moderator, R.E.A., today. Now, I have met R.E.A. many times, and I'd love to hear his stories. But it's also true that much beyond being my friend, R.E.A. is a founder of One World Lights, a community of global citizens with a shared vision of people everywhere supporting a course change for humanity by supporting each other. R.E.A. is also the author of Holy Beggars, A Journey from Hyde Street to Jerusalem. What a wonderful title. It's a memoir of a student, a spiritual teacher, and the spiritual revolution in 1960s San Francisco that transformed the way millions of Americans experience faith and spirituality. So without much ado, I will hand it over to R.E.A. to start off the conversation. A very good morning, R.E.A.
Good morning, Shiv, and thanks. It's great to be doing this call with you. So I'd like to say a few words of introduction about Yoav Peck. He is the co-executive director of the Sulfa Peace Project. Their purpose, as is stated on their website, goes like this. We are Israelis and Palestinians who meet to encounter the other in our full humanity. The purpose of Sulfa is to end conflict and hostility among people so that they may conduct their relationships in peace and amity. Any political future must address the human needs of both sides. We at Sulfa stand on the front lines of the struggle to return decency and compassion to our shared land. Every month or two, we hold tribal fires in which 50 to 150 Palestinians and Israelis gather to reach beyond arguments, beyond political posturing, to the essential humanity longing to be heard. We pray and sing together, we enjoy a meal and quiet informal time, and we work in listening circles, creating a quality of awareness and attention to the other, sorely lacking in our respective societies. I have to say, as I'm reading this, that this sounds like there's a lot of overlap with awakened circles. According to Yoav, we persistently work with an uncooperative military to obtain entry permits for West Bank Palestinians so that we can be together. Sometimes we meet in the territories to make sulcha available to those Palestinians who cannot leave. As we depart from the tribal fire, we are profoundly empowered, carrying with us renewed inspiration, hope, and determination to continue working to bring the conflict to an end. Yoav was born in the U.S. and grew up on the East Coast in a non-religious American Jewish family. His parents were very committed to supporting the new state of Israel as a home for refugees from the Holocaust. Full disclosure, in the 1950s, Yoav and I lived in the same small town in New Jersey. We went to the same high school, but were 3 years different in age, so didn't really know each other very well. But we both wound up in the Bay Area. Yoav attended university at UC Berkeley and graduated with a BA in sociology in 1971. During his time in Berkeley, he was active in the peace movement to end the war in Vietnam. Later, he received an MA in organizational psychology from Norwich University in Vermont. In 1973, Yoav immigrated to Israel and joined a kibbutz, where he lived as an active member for 15 years. Like most Israeli citizens, he served his time in the military and was with the Israeli army in Lebanon in 1982. After completing his active duty as a soldier who had experienced the reality of violent conflict, he decided to become a different kind of warrior in the cause of peace. Professionally, Yoav is an organizational psychologist, coach, and consultant who specialized in systemic programs for the advancement of human dignity. He lives with his wife, Frumit, in Jerusalem. Yoav, and I want to let everyone know, for those of you who are in the Bay Area, that Yoav and his Palestinian Sulcha colleague and co-leader, Fula Yuba, will be traveling in the U.S. in March and in the Bay Area on March 6th to tell their story in person over here. Yoav, great to have this chance to have this conversation with you, and thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Arye. Thank you for including me in the Awaken calls.
So I want to start off with asking you a little bit about the present and then going into some of your history of how you got here. So one thing I want to mention for people who are listening is that Yoav blogs on his Facebook page, and for those of you who are interested in reading it, there are very poignant entries that he makes from the point of view of being in Israel today and seeing what's going on there. Yoav, I just want to ask you if you could share with us maybe something recently that has come up in Sulcha in one of your recent gatherings. You know, what's the mood? What's the feeling? Give us a sample of what the conversation is like today.
Well, people are dealing with a lot of despair, surrounded by despair, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. We look around and our present government is doing everything it can to avoid peace, and the Palestinians are facing waves of occupying violence, and the Israelis are basically not seeing any horizon or any light at the end of the tunnel these days. So that's the sort of prevailing mood. And in that mood, we still continue, as we have for the last 17 years, to bring groups of Palestinians and Israelis together, where we create a vibrant alternative to the despair that surrounds us. People arrive from all over the West Bank and from all over Israel to our gatherings, where I'll just give you an example of something that happened at a recent gathering. Young Palestinian got off the bus, and it was his first gathering, and he looked around, and he was not happy. He had been persuaded to come, but he was not happy to be there, and he looked suspicious, and he limped. Later on, we found out that his limp had to do with a severe beating that he received at the hands of Israeli soldiers before being put in jail, and he was around 18, and we coupled him with a young Israeli settler who had agreed to come, and he was about to go into the army, and somehow, intuitively, we felt that the two of them were a good match. We put them together, and there was a lot of suspicion and distance at first, and then they began talking. They both spoke halfway decent English, so they were able to communicate. And during the evening, we tried to get them to join the collective activities, and they refused because something very special was happening between the two of them. And we saw them exchanging cigarettes and beginning to laugh together, and at any rate, to make a long story short, at the end of the evening, it was clear that something had happened between the two of them, and we had to get the Palestinians back on the bus to get back to the roadblock before the curfew. And before he left, the Palestinian turned to the Israeli and said, in about a month, you're going to be in the army, and I'm still going to be across the road throwing rocks at you soldiers at the roadblocks. Please, be careful out there. And it was a magical moment. Then he climbed onto the bus, and the two of them have actually stayed in touch.
That is so amazing. What an amazing story. You know, of all the two people in the world who I would imagine would be the least likely to become friends, those two would have sounded like that. So what's the secret? How does this work? I mean, people where there is so much reason to hate each other, what is that magic that happens, and what, you know, what are the conditions that allow that to happen, that they can become friends like that?
It's really in the listening. You know, God gave us a subtle hint when he gave us one mouth but two ears. And, you know, so many of us are so intent on saying what it is we want to say that we forget about listening. And particularly in Israel and Palestine, the level of listening is really quite dismal, and people are sort of waiting for you to take a breath so that they can leap in and say the next thing they have to say. At Sulcha, we make we very much emphasize the importance of listening. And the heart of our monthly gatherings is listening circles, where we use the Native American technique of passing a speaking object, something that has some significance for the facilitator, and only the person holding that object speaks. We don't argue. We really have people deliver themselves to whoever's speaking, and to listen from the heart and to speak from the heart. We stay away from political arguments, because people can argue politically every day, all the time, if they want to. But actually listening to each other's stories and listening to people talk about their lives and themselves is quite rare. So what creates safety enough so that people can open up is that we pay attention to each other and work more from the heart than we do from the head.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I'm curious about is the Palestinians and the Israeli Jews meeting each other. There's a situation of such inequality where the one side has so much more power to act, to travel, to live their lives than the other. And how does that inequality, how does that play out in the dynamic of the conversation, or does it?
Well, it does. You know, the Israelis are aware of the power imbalance when we come into these meetings. And for the Palestinians, it's quite unique to have a representative of the occupier sitting there and looking into his eyes and just listening to him. So that's a piece of it. The other piece is that Israelis talk about themselves and talk about their lives, but they very often also talk about their shame, our shame. Mm. And it's a critical piece, because the willingness of Israelis to acknowledge the damage that's been done to the Palestinian people by virtue of the establishment of the State of Israel is quite unique for the Palestinians. And for them to hear the pain and discomfort that Israelis experience when we consider what our government is doing and what many of us ourselves have done as combatants, that really enables many Palestinians to come out of their shell and to feel, in the course of one evening, to establish enough trust so that they're willing to share themselves quite openly.
Is that a surprise to a lot of Palestinians to hear Israelis talk like that?
Yes, it's a surprise. I also want to say that the Israelis might be part of the occupying force, but we also have a story. Each of us has a story. And it's important to the Israelis to establish a situation in which not only are they listening to the Palestinians, but the Palestinians are listening to us. And it means listening to the histories of our families, many of whom have been through the Holocaust 70 years ago. It includes Palestinians listening to the dilemmas that Israelis with a social conscience are in when we do our army service. And it wouldn't work if it was all about the Palestinians. So
yeah.
I'll just give an example. During the 2014 summer war in Gaza, we did a gathering at a small Jewish Arab settlement, the first Jewish Arab settlement in Israel, Neve Shalom. And while we were sitting outside having dinner, a missile was fired from Gaza and was intercepted over our heads. And exploded over our heads, and it was, you know, we looked at each other, and it wasn't clear which way it was all going to go. And then one of the Palestinians asked an Israeli woman how she was feeling about all of this, and she shared that her three sons were all simultaneously in the army and serving in Gaza. And she talked about her fear. And despite the fact that the Palestinians, many of them had family in Gaza, and of course the casualties in Gaza were much heavier than they were in Israel, and you wouldn't have expected the Palestinians to be willing to hear the mother of three soldiers talking about her fear for her sons, and yet they did. And there were a lot of tears on both sides, and you know, it was extremely moving to the Israelis that despite the fact that it was our government bombarding Gaza, that the Palestinians were also willing to hear our fear for our kids and our fear of the missiles that were being shot at us.
Yeah, I get that. I'm curious, the other way around, is there anything that is typically surprising for the Israelis to hear from the Palestinians as they're listening to the Palestinian stories?
Well, I think it's less surprising, but it's you know, there's a difference between reading the newspapers and seeing the numbers of casualties, and the Palestinians are not called Palestinians, they're called terrorists, whatever reporting is being done. That's so that there's a real dehumanization of the Palestinians, and the Israelis pay attention to the stories, the actual occurrences that the Palestinians confront, and we can't take away their pain, but there's something wonderful about listening to their pain, and it's what opens up the doors of the communication that happens.
Yeah, that's about the stories. Now, I want to ask you one more question about the present, then I want to ask you a little bit about some of your life journey, but the question I'm asking is, you opened up by saying how much pessimism there is on both sides, and no one seems to see any solution to the conflict. And I'm wondering, in that kind of situation, why do people even bother? What are people thinking when they're, whether they're Palestinian, whether they're Israeli, what are they thinking they're going to accomplish in talking to each other, and why are they doing it?
Well, usually people come because they've been persuaded by a friend who's been to show up. They arrive with lots of skepticism, and they really don't expect to be surprised or to feel comfortable. We actually do have, in periods like this, we do have a problem recruiting people, bringing people in. The Sulcha gatherings include a core group of people who come every time, but of course what most interests us is reaching out to people who would never ordinarily find themselves in this situation on either side, and they just come and bring their skepticism along with them, and then we go to work, and you can actually see people melting. One of the members of our board is a Palestinian whose family was driven out of central Israel in the 1948 war, and then they moved to Gaza and fled Gaza in the 67 war and moved to a refugee camp in Jordan, and he grew up there hating every mention of the Israelis, and he finally, as a young man, decided to come to Palestine and to join the struggle and to find Israelis to kill, and that was his intention, and he still is willing to talk about that today.
Wow.
But he was invited against his better judgment to attend a Sulcha gathering, and he describes being absolutely flabbergasted by what he saw and felt among the Israelis. And with time, he understood that you have to make distinctions between different kinds of Israelis, and that these people, the Sulcha people, are there to support him and to seek peace together with him. And as I say, he's now been active for about 8 years, and he's a member of the board.
Wow.
So, you know, you can only start where people are and move from there.
It sounds like maybe what you're saying is that even if the larger picture invokes a lot of despair and there's no light at the end of the tunnel in sight, that on a personal level there's still stuff that people can do that's meaningful.
Absolutely. As you know, and we a normal evening will include the listening circles I described, but also we share a meal together, and we bless the food in Arabic and in Hebrew before we eat, and we sing, and we play music, and we have informal time, so that you know, we come at it from different angles during the evening, and something always works with people. If it's not the listening circle, then it's the informal time around dinner, and something works. But yeah, as you say, it's really the personal connection. It's sitting across from someone who's listening to you and who's passing the rice, and you know, just people in the end.
So Yoav, I want to go back in time a little bit to the 1960s, and you were going to school at UC Berkeley. I was in San Francisco doing my thing. We didn't have much contact with each other then. But then at a certain point, as you were, I guess around the time you were graduating, you decided to go to Israel. And I'm curious, why would you leave a place where there's so much financial opportunity, a relatively stable country, depending on how you look at that, and, you know, go to a place like Israel? What motivated you to do that?
Discomfort. I had Jewish friends who were marching in Palestinian support marches in Berkeley, and I was not, because I didn't feel that I had enough information to be able to take a stand. And I basically came to Israel, gave myself a few weeks to try to figure things out and develop a position, a political position about the Middle East. Well, 3 weeks was not enough, and 44 years later, I'm still working on figuring out what my position is. But what happened to me is I fell in love. I was blown away by the Israelis. The country is beautiful, but even more beautiful are the people. There's a warmth here, an immediacy, a straight talk ethos. And I had wonderful conversations, and I felt wanted. I felt that people, wherever I went, reached out to me and said, "You're a Jew, your place is here." And at first I was very irritated by that. And then I began to feel this incredible sense of belonging that I really haven't felt in America ever. And when I realized how good I felt in Israel, I was persuaded to stay longer, and the longer I stayed, the better I liked it. I also traveled to Palestinian refugee camps and talked to Palestinians. Back then, in 72, you could take a bus to Gaza, and I did, and I was escorted through a refugee camp by two young guys, and I saw through their eyes what occupation meant, although it was only 5 years of occupation at that time. And I think something about the intensity of the mix, my love increasing love for the Israelis and my concern for what Israel's existence meant to the Palestinians. There was something challenging and exciting about trying to embrace that contradiction. And the longer I stayed, the more I felt at home, and eventually I just, my first wife and I moved to, our tickets were going to run out, so we had to get back to the States, and we lived in a cave on an island in Spain, and we sat there for 2 months and wondered why we were going back to California. And when we couldn't find an answer, we made the decision to immigrate to Israel and went back to the States and made a little money and got married and came in 73, just after the Yom Kippur War.
So after that, you wound up living and being an active member in a kibbutz. And I remember back in those days, there was a kind of idealism that many Americans and American Jews felt about the kibbutz. Over here in the States, it was all about capitalism and making money and advancing yourself in your career. And the idealism, the values around kibbutz life were very different. Can you say a little bit about what that was, what your experience of living in a kibbutz in a socialist environment like that for so many years was like for you?
Well, at first it was just wonderful. I had lived in a commune in Berkeley in the 60s, and that was sort of my value system, and the kibbutz value system coincided. The years I lived on kibbutz, I didn't own a wallet and I didn't have a key to my house because you didn't need a key to your house. It was a collective society where people supported each other, and 12 people made meals for 600 while the other people did things for the people who were working in the kitchen. It was socialism in action, and I loved it. It was an English kibbutz, English working class Jews who came to Israel in 48, and I loved the people and I liked my work. I started in agriculture and eventually went back to doing psychology, but I liked being a part of that community.
What motivated you to leave?
Well, I was sent by the kibbutz movement to the United States as an emissary, and I experienced, I proudly represented Israel in the States, but I came back having, you can't keep them down on the farm once they've seen Paris, and I came back having lived an independent life, and on the kibbutz, if I wanted to work in my profession, I had to go through the works committee, and I remember 1 year they said, yeah, you can go back to your profession, but only next year, this year, we want you to run the dining room. And I just felt myself getting older, and I was less willing to compromise.
Yeah.
And the kibbutz also was undergoing change. Increasingly privatizing, less social glue holding people together, some quabbling about property, and when televisions were introduced into the members' apartments, I grew up on television in the United States, and I really didn't want that for myself. to be shut up in my kibbutz apartment with a television. So all of it came together, and I just realized it was time to move on.
How interesting about the sort of complex relationship between individual and collective well-being. You know, there's one more thing that I want to ask you about, I'm curious about, and that is your experience of being in the army, of fighting in Lebanon, and what caused you afterwards to make the decisions to be a peace warrior?
Well, I joined the peace movement, but I did my army service, and then I did reserve duty until I was turned out to pasture. So for me, it's I won't say it's not a contradiction, but it's a contradiction I can live with. And in June of 1982, I was called up to my unit on the evening before we entered Lebanon, and I believed at the time what I was told, which was that we were going in for a few days, no more than 25 kilometers into Lebanon, and we were going to make the Northern Galilee safe by doing that. And yet, when I got inside Lebanon, we weren't told the truth by our own officers. We were listening to the BBC and realized that the Israeli army was already in the suburbs of Beirut, and that it looked like it was going to be a very long war, which it turned out to be. So I was really in a crisis because I didn't want to be part of an aggressive taking over of Lebanon. And yet, and this might be hard for Americans to understand, but I, when you join the army, you develop a very close relationship with the guys you're with. And for me to walk out on them and to say, to throw down my gun and to say, I'm not participating in this, you guys work it out, I'm going home or going to jail, I chose not to do that. On the other hand, when I got a 48-hour leave, I went home and said hello to my family and my kibbutz neighbors, and took off my uniform and went to Tel Aviv to demonstrate against the war that I was fighting in.
Wow.
And it might sound like a ridiculous contradiction, but as I said before, living in Israel is about embracing contradictions sometimes and not being able to really resolve them. And after the demonstration, I came home and got some clean clothes and went back to Lebanon until I was discharged a few weeks later.
Were there any sort of legal consequences from the army or from the government to your embracing contradictions in the way you did?
No, I didn't advertise that I had gone to the demonstration, and no. Actually, what happened to me in Lebanon was I was a munitions technician, but what I saw was that many of the reservists that I served with were falling apart, and I went to my commander and I said, you know, I'm a psychotherapist, and I see people are in deep trouble, and he gave me a tent, and he said, this is your office. I want you to interview the people who are who say they're going crazy, because some of them are, and some of them are faking to get out of serving, and your job is to figure out who's faking and who's not. Well, it was a terrible mission, but for the most part, I gave people the benefit of the doubt, and if someone was desperate enough to pretend he was falling apart, I figured he wasn't going to be functional. So that's what I was doing during the day, and at night I was sending munitions into Beirut.
Wow.
Speaking of contradictions.
You talk about embracing contradictions, and I'm wondering if that is kind of a key to being, I don't know, fully human in a situation like that. There are so many people, it seems, who don't embrace the contradictions, who say, this is my stance. I'm wondering if that's what it is, that there's something about embracing contradictions that is key to being a peacemaker.
Well, you know, Israel continues to be threatened, and we do need an army. My kids have served in the army, and And I feel that it's an obligation to be part of defending us. And when I speak to Palestinians, I never conceal the fact that I've served in the army, because I think it's important for them to embrace that contradiction as well, the fact that they're talking to a peace activist who cares about them visibly, on the one hand, but who also has served in the army and believes that Israelis need to continue to maintain a strong defense army until the danger has passed. So you use the phrase taking a stand. I really do feel that I take a stand about peace, but I have blood on my hands, and I think most of us do. And being willing to, and many of the Palestinians do as well. You know, one of my best friends in the peace movement spent 10 years in jail for stabbing Israelis, and we're very close, and we're both peace activists. So it's just the way things are here.
Yeah, it's not simple. I just want to sort of step aside for a moment and speak to all of you who are listening to the conversation. In about 10 or 12 minutes, we're going to be opening it up. So if you have a question for Yoav, I just want to remind you that those of you who are on the phone, you can dial *6, and you'll be put in the queue. If you're live streaming, you can submit a question online, and Shiv will be reading that question later. So, Yoav, I want to get into something that you and I touched on a bit when we spoke a few days ago, and that is the peace movement in Israel. You said something that really surprised me, that there were roughly, you feel, in the neighborhood of around 60 different peace organizations in Israel, and that's really surprising. Can you sort of give us a picture of, zoom out a little bit, what is it like in Israel from the point of view of people who are in favor of peace and people who are on the other side who feel that a strong military solution is needed? And what's the Israeli society like right now?
In a recent study, 48% of the Israeli public, the Jewish Israeli public, said that left-wingers are traitors. So along with racism about Arabs, about Palestinians, there's a lot of hatred directed at peace activists. And yet we make a point of flying the Israeli flag. I feel that my peace activism is an act of patriotism, and yet we're facing increasing opposition. People who have despaired of there ever being peace with the Palestinians, many of them former liberals, have turned very strongly to the right, and feel that we just have to be strong and to show the Palestinians who's boss, and hope that eventually the Palestinians will understand that they can never win the struggle, and they'll give up. And of course that won't happen, and any more than it did in Vietnam, when this tiny country defeated the most powerful army in the world. Because when you have nothing to lose, the only thing you have left is to struggle. And so if we are, to say it brutally, if we are stuck with the Palestinians, then we're going to have to turn our enemies into partners. We don't have to love them. We don't have to go and have hummus with them. But we are going to have to work out how to cooperate with them. So, as you said, there are tens of peace organizations continuing this work. Sometimes peace activists get beat up on their way back to their car from a demonstration by right-wingers who were waiting for us. But the peace movement is steadfast. It's very small, despite the number of organizations. And, you know, there are people who have despaired, but we try to strengthen each other. There are not only many organizations, there are several umbrella organizations that bring the peace organizations together, and we offer each other mutual support. I'm not sure what else I can tell you.
No, that's helpful. You know, you mentioned a number. I think you said that of Israeli Jews, 38% think that people who are involved with the peace movement are traitors. I wonder on the other side, what, you know, do you know roughly what proportion of the Israeli Jewish population are either involved in the peace movement or whose beliefs are aligned with the peace movement?
Well, that's interesting. I couldn't tell you how many are peace activists, actually, but the studies continue to show that a majority of Israelis, even if they don't consider themselves leftists or peace activists, a majority of Israelis continue to believe that the two-state solution is the only way we are going to get out of this conflict. So there is still support for a negotiated settlement in which the Palestinians end up with an independent state of their own. We're in danger of losing that majority, and it's certainly smaller than it used to be. But mainstream Israelis, you know, there are people... Life can be quite comfortable for Israelis. You know, this is a prosperous country, relatively speaking, and it might be hard to get to the end of the month without an overdraft in your bank account, but you can live a very comfortable life in Israel and ignore what's happening a few kilometers down the road. For example, in Jerusalem, we're just a couple of kilometers from massive refugee camps on the other side of the barrier wall, and yet if you want to blind yourself, you can. And then what your opinions are likely to be about defense is we have to be strong. They'll never give up, those Palestinians, so we just have to overcome them. And you know, what's most depressing is when you talk to right-wing Israelis, my question I always ask them, what's your vision of the future? And they have none. They actually have none. There is, our prime minister has never, in the 10 years he's been in office, has never offered a vision of Israel at peace. He prefers to show us as a beleaguered country that will always be at war. And he actually said that we will live by the sword forever just a year ago. And many people have sort of resigned themselves to that being a description of reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm struck with the thought that there is a kind of similarity in Israel and in the U.S. right now with divided populations. That you have a situation in Israel where, as you say, the majority of Israelis so far favor a two-state solution, and yet Netanyahu's policy is tilting toward a one-state solution, and similar to the states, that the a majority of people here favor one vision of America, and the minority that support Trump look at a different kind of America. And I don't know, it just seems similar. What does it look like to you?
Yeah, there are incredible parallels between what's happening there and what's happening here. I'm a little jealous of all of the activity that's blossomed before and after the election there. I'd love to see that kind of vitality in our weary peace movement here. But yes, I think one of the strongest similarities is that there's a leadership vacuum at the top in the United States and in Israel. We share the fact that Trump and Netanyahu, I call them Net Trump Yahoo, that they are what the psychologists call representatives of the dark triad, which is consists of psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism. And I think if you take a look at Trump and a look at Netanyahu, you can see that dark triad operative in both of them. The other thing that we both have in common is that if we don't reach out to the people who hate us and the people who support Trump and Netanyahu, we are never going to lay the foundation for change. So I think a huge challenge for all of us is to start talking to the people we disagree with, and to do it with compassion, and to do it with listening, which is stronger than our talking, and to hear their stories. Because ultimately, until there's a sea change in the masses of population, all of the progressive movements will be talking to themselves. So this is a common challenge for all of us. How do you talk to someone who screams at you and does everything he can to insult you? I have been told in the streets when talking to the public, it's too bad you didn't die in the Holocaust with the rest of your family. And I've heard terrible things. But there are techniques and ways of thinking about these encounters that can enable us to weather those kinds of attacks and to really seek the crack in the armor of the people who are angry at us, because everyone has a crack, and it's a test of our creativity and our sensitivity to see how well we can identify the place in which the humanity inside that person is still alive and well.
Yoav, that's a beautiful summary and a beautiful place, I think, for us to transition. You know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, okay, it's not only about each of us finding a way to reach out to people who are being oppressed, but it's also up to each of us to find a way to reach out to the oppressors. Not a simple task, but maybe a very necessary one. So we're at the point where we're opening things up for questions and conversation. And Shiv, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Yoav and Aryeh. I must say that my official role is to play the host and to monitor the controls and the call, but I've been so intently listening to what is happening, because not only is it a topic close to my heart, but for people like us who are young and who do not have the awareness of what is happening in a place so far away, it's really fascinating, and I'm really humbled by what I've heard. I'll go on to some of the observations. I have a question for Yoav from Jerry. Jerry says, I'm a mediator in California working with...
I am a what?
Mediator.
Okay.
In California, working with Aikido principles as applied to verbal conflicts. Aikido, as taught in Israel, has brought Jews and Arabs together to train in martial art of peace. Are you familiar with such efforts? And can you address their psychological dynamics? He does mention of a website, communicationharmony.com.
Well, thank you. I love this question. No, I am not familiar with the Aikido community in Israel and Palestine. But yes, there's something, the little I know about Aikido, having studied Japanese karate in the 70s back in Berkeley, is that instead of offering resistance to another's aggression, one finds a way to join with the momentum of the other, of the adversary, and then to assert some kind of control or mastery once you've done that. And that really is at the heart of the work we're doing with the public here. Instead of arguing and fighting in an oppositional way, we look for ways of going with someone's pain if we can get them to go beyond their fury and to express their pain. And they can. I mean, you know, if I ask someone in the middle of an argument that he's trying to pick with me, if I ask him, what are your hopes for your children and your grandchildren? So sometimes his honest concern about that can come forward, and he feels that I've joined him in his concerns rather than opposing him. And I know, you know, that this is really a novice or an ignorant person talking about this principle, but if I got it right, this is a great direction, and I will check out that site.
Thank you so much, Yoav. We also now have a question from Wendy. Wendy, please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Yoav.
Hi.
Such a pleasure to hear you again. So I have a couple of questions. My first one is, what do you feel are the motivations for people to come to a Solcha event anyway? I know you mentioned that people have been invited, but there must be something there for them to be invited in the first place. So have you been able to understand kind of what that spark is on either side to allow people or to encourage people to participate in the first place? And I know that for Palestinians, it can be a very dangerous thing to participate in peace work. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, and you've been recently alluding to it in this conversation, and I've been very inspired by your blogging on Facebook. You recently wrote about a situation where you were confronted with a right-wing Israeli, and you turned it around, not that he agreed with your views, but that there was some ice broken there. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the specifics on how that came to pass.
Well, thank you, Randy. As I was listening to you, I wrote down on this paper in front of me the word longing, because under the skepticism that people who have never been to Sulcha feel, what we see is an incredible longing for something different from what's happening now. Their daily lives, both the Palestinians and the Israelis in different ways, their daily lives are so full of how grim things are, or people painting how dangerous and grim and sometimes how dangerous they really are if you're a Palestinian. And there is a deep longing in people to connect, to be in a safe environment, to express a closeness. And I'm just picturing it was under a full moon just last week, around the campfire at the end of the evening. You just saw people's faces glowing after they had had a long listening circle about men's roles and women's roles in Palestinian and Israeli societies. They came out and they had dinner and then they danced and sang around the fire, you know. And we were attacked once by Palestinians who were not at Sulcha, and they said, how can you have these celebrations, dancing and singing around a fire, when the occupation is still going on? They call it normalization. And that's a curse word in Palestinian society, and it's thrown at the people who come to our gatherings. But our response is that if we don't celebrate, then what are we struggling for? I mean, we must be able to create islands of aliveness and joy and comfort and safeness in order to recharge our batteries to carry on facing the reality of our everyday life. So I really think it's people are just dying to change things and to not be afraid anymore. And the other night with these two Orthodox right-wing guys, you know, I could hear in the way that they were chattering at the beginning of the conversation, I could hear how thin their proclamations of horrible, vulgar proclamations about Palestinians. It wasn't coming from a deep place at all. And eventually I just said to this guy, you know, I hear this coming out of your mouth and I'm looking at you and I offered you a cigarillo and you accepted it and we're standing here together. I feel like you have a good heart, that you're actually a good guy. And even though I hate the things you're saying, that's not the way I feel about you. And something there turned him around. Because he said the same thing back to me. And we ended up, I gave him my card and invited him to the next Sulcha gathering. I don't know if he'll come, but you get what I'm saying. It was just, you know, and at the beginning of the conversation, he was just disgusted when I said to him, you know, if my daughter wants to marry a Palestinian and the guy is a good guy, so I would give her my blessing, and he almost killed me. I mean, he was just, he couldn't believe it, I was saying that. And by the end of the conversation, he didn't care. He knew my opinions, but he there was a connection that had been created.
Thank you. The story I remember. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you so much for your question, Randy. Yoav, I have an observation from Michelle Rawson. And she writes, today's share by Yoav led me to a poem by Mark Nepo. It focuses on what we can do. Accepting this by Mark Nepo. We cannot eliminate hunger, but we can feed each other. We cannot eliminate loneliness, but we can hold each other. We cannot eliminate pain, but we can live a life of compassion. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Indeed, indeed. And I had a question. I had the good fortune of visiting both Israel and Palestine a while ago. We went all around the country, and it was a blessing for us as we could meet the people. But that was close to 10 years back. But with social media today, with a lot of ability to connect people, would you have any observation of, is it helping connect people the right way, or is it actually marginalizing and polarizing people? How has social media helped or hurt your cause? Is something that I wanted to know.
Oh, it's helped enormously because, you know, it's the powerlessness of the Palestinians is so overwhelming in so many aspects of their life. But anyone, I mean, it's a great equalizer, Facebook. You know, anyone can meet me at Sulcha, ask me my name, and then the next day ask me to be a friend, to befriend him. And I have tens of Palestinians who immediately after a gathering became friends on Facebook, and I see their news. Some of it's in Arabic, and I don't understand it, and they see mine, and We like each other. it's a great tool. I don't know. I'm not particularly sophisticated in the dangers of the internet, but from the perspective of a tiny organization with a $30,000 a year budget, this is an amazing tool for connecting with the Palestinians.
Interesting. Thank you so
and of
much.
And of course, connecting with each other. We advertise our events, and you know, it's just very useful.
Absolutely. And it was interesting that you said that. I was just wondering, as you mentioned that there are some comments which are in Arabic. Has language ever been a barrier when Israelis and Palestinians meet face to face? And if so, how do you overcome that?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I can't believe I didn't talk about it. Well, all of our gatherings at Sulcha, we work with translators so that no one is left in the dark. We have three languages because there's always someone from abroad who comes and only speaks English. So the big barrier is that most of the young Palestinians don't speak anything but Arabic. And so we have to learn Arabic. In fact, I'm studying Arabic, and I feel that if someone wants to do something useful as a peace activist, the thing to do is to learn the language of the people we're supporting. And it's a wonderful language, and it's a joy to learn it. I happen to have a magnificent teacher, and some of the Palestinians speak some English, so we manage. The act of translating actually slows things down. You know, if someone's saying in Arabic what I just said in Hebrew, then I have time to breathe a few times and think about whether the next thing I'm going to say is useful or not. So, you know, it's like turning a difficulty into an opportunity.
Wow. Wonderful. It almost makes us feel like we should translate every conversation we have, even if it's in the same language, so that we can slow ourselves down. Very interesting. Arye, did you have a follow-up question as well? And I can come in later with some observations.
Yeah, I did. And maybe, Koza, I hope you can find your way on the line there. Yoav, I've been thinking that what you've been talking about has mostly been about outward actions, how to act with another person. But it occurs to me that to be able to face someone who's screaming at you, disagreeing with you, saying they hate you, whatever, and be able to say to them, I can see and appreciate your essential goodness. There's got to be some inner work going on there. And I'm curious about what inner practices, if any, you have. I know that you haven't been what we normally think of as a religious person. Do you have any kind of inner practices for transforming yourself that you have worked on in order to allow yourself the ability to respond to people in this compassionate way?
Well, some colleagues and I do a workshop for peace activists called Beyond Persuasion, which is a workshop for training in the art of reaching out to a hostile public, and or to anyone for that matter. But people report increasingly not being able to talk to the public, but now also not being able to talk to their families, and having huge rifts in the families over politics. So one of the preparatory pieces of the workshop is what we call taking on a role. I mean, you're not in a normal conversation. You say to yourself, okay, I have an objective in this conversation. It's to turn this antipathy into human contact and maybe to be able to get some ideas challenged. So if I want to do that, I have to be in a role. So putting on a hat and saying, this is, you know, an imaginary hat, and saying, I'm now in the role of engaging with this person. That's one thing. The other thing is we use a concept we call the umbrella. An umbrella is what we imagine to be putting over ourselves, and the rain is the horrible things that people say to us. So if we want to preserve our own serenity and or relative calm in one of these encounters, it's important to, as part of the role, to actually imagine that I have an umbrella on, and I am committed to not having my hurt feelings run the way I'm going to respond. And then it's possible to hear all kinds of things and keep looking for the opening to be able to make deeper contact with the person.
When you're standing under that umbrella and you're going to say something positive, is that merely a script, or do you really see, do you really experience the goodness in that person? And if so, how do you sort of align yourself to see and experience that goodness?
Well, that takes us back to why I fell in love with Israel. You know, Israelis who say hateful things are still beautiful in my eyes. And, you know, it's easy to just love these people even when they're being obnoxious. So I don't know. It's, you know, it's almost like there's this nice person locked up inside a prison who's just trying to find a way out of there. And if we can unlock the doors, then we've done our part. You know, the guys I talked to the other night, they didn't transform their opinions about peace, but maybe they went home and talked to their wives and said, I met a leftist who made some sense and who wasn't such a bad guy. And, you know, that's one step for humanity, and it feels good when you go home.
Great.
Thank you, Yoav. Thank you. Arya, we do have a question back from Kozo. Kozo is on now. Please go ahead, Kozo.
Thanks, Shiv. Yoav, thank you for this beautiful conversation on peace. I wanted to ask you a question about the role of forgiveness in the work that you do. And if you have any stories of, you know, radical acts of forgiveness that cause transformation in the dialogue or in the individual.
That's a great question. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I talked earlier about shame. And the place that forgiveness begins for me is forgiving myself. So, you know, sometimes I'll be talking to people and I'll say, the Jewish people were on a sinking ship in Europe during the Holocaust, and when they jumped out of the sinking ship into Israel, the lifeboat of Israel, there were people in the lifeboat and we did damage. You know, and Arye was saying, does it become a script? Well, that's something I've said, I guess, a lot of times. But the damage we did, you know, that in 1948, 700,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes or ran from our armies. To forgive myself for that is not easy. The only thing that really helps is doing something. You know, when I'm putting together a sulcha evening, I don't have a problem being nice to myself and being forgiving, even if I was part of this occupation. I am part of this occupation, and yet the doing puts all of that stuff in the background. But some people of noble souls among the people at Sulcha that I know are able to forgive occupiers, people who have put them in jail, and you know, they want something bigger than resentment in their lives. And there's some very gracious moments. I think that for me, I'll never forget the Israeli woman talking about her fear for her sons in the invading army of Israel, and watching Palestinians listening to her intently and being compassionate towards her as she wept. That was pretty miraculous for us.
Wow.
So thank you. It's a huge subject and so complex. There's a wonderful, just put a plug in for Kevin Rudd. It's called the Sorry Speech in Australia. When the Prime Minister of Australia turned to the Aborigines in Parliament and he said to them, "I'm sorry for what we have done in Australia to your people." And I just so badly would like to see Netanyahu. I think I'll wait a while before he can deliver that speech.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gozo. Thank you so much. Yoav, one of my friends was wondering, is there humor during these meetings in the evening? You touched upon music, but it is a very naive question. When we bring people together, the situation could become very grim. Does humor ever come in, or does it even solve or alleviate the pain during these meetings?
For sure, Shiv, it's absolutely a wonderful part of it, where not only do people listen to each other in conversations, but they laugh together at these gatherings. And I actually, speaking of plugs, I will tell you that one of the most professionally humorous people I know is Fula Jube, who is coming to the States with me on our fundraising tour in March. And she's a professional clown, and an actress, and she is a medical clown with terminal children at Hadassah Hospital. And she brings a twinkling eye and a wonderful laugh to every meeting that she attends. She's one of our leaders at Sulcha. So, it's so precious. Sometimes we're laughing through our tears, but for sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Arye, did you have any observations, any final questions before we go towards closing?
I just wanted to also say what Yoav was just saying, that Yoav and Fulha will, for those of us in the Bay Area, will be here on March 6th, and maybe, Shiv, we can include a link to that information mm-hmm. when we send out the thank you, so people who are interested can meet them in person.
Absolutely.
The other thing I'd be delighted is if anyone wants to follow up this call by sending us an email, that'd be great. The email address is Sulcha Peace Project, one word, Sulcha, S-U-L-H-A, Peace Project 4, @gmail. And that's we'd love to hear from you, and we'll be in New York City and New Jersey as well in March, so... and Seattle. So, love to hear from anyone.
Thank you. Thank you, Yoav. We'll make sure we include the email address and all information when we reach out to the listeners. Yoav, as always, we do want to know at Service Space, how can we, as the larger Service Space community, support or spread information about your work? How can we support you?
Well, thank you for that question. It's funny. Sometimes I'm asked to speak as a spokesman for the left to college groups that come over here from the United States. And one of the things I always tell them is, do a sulcha in your town. Anyone can locate five Muslims or Palestinians or both, and the Jews are always available, and The Christians are interested as well, and to put together a meeting. And I would be supportive of that by providing materials for simulation games you could do. And, you know, so people can do sulcha anywhere. We would love to host people when they come here, if we can coordinate one of our gatherings with your visit. And we would appreciate your following us. You know, we're on Facebook, and we have to improve our website, but we actually have a website and the email that I gave you. So we would like to get a newsletter out to people who are in touch with us and to let you know when we're going to be in your neck of the woods. I'm sure there are other ways people could support us, and we're open to suggestions, but that would be a great start.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll definitely find the best ways to connect. And as we end the call from Service Space, personally and from the rest of the world, I want to thank you, Yoav, for what you have done. For people like us who are coming to a stage in life where we're starting to question, hey, is it just about me? Shouldn't I be getting more involved in the community? People like you have always and continue to be the beacons, the light that we hope to get energy from and move forward. Today's call was extra fascinating for me because I have been to so many places in and around Israel and Palestine, but I must admit I have never looked at the place as you have seen, because I did visit the place as a tourist. Today and tomorrow when I do visit, I hope with your guidance that I would be looking at the place with a new light. You talked about dehumanization and how important it is to humanize people before this can be an engaging conversation. It is something that I'll hold close to my heart, and to all the people that I talk to, I'll hold this in conversation about how important it is to humanize. You talked about a sense of belonging, and it's so interesting that you said that even as you were in the army, as you were seeing certain things, your love for Israelis never went down. And in fact, I think you alluded to the fact that the love increased. So this compassion, when you see something wrong happening, is very interesting. That's talked about embracing contradiction. And you said accepting the fact that sometimes that you cannot resolve them. It was indeed very, very enlightening for us. And I always want to end every conversation with a sense of hope. And that came in when you said, you see in people a sense of longing to change status quo and to aspire for something more. And it is with that hope that there is a constant sense of longing in everybody. And with guiders and teachers like you, that sense of longing will come to the surface and people will meet, humanize each other, and share their heart to make for a better world. It is with that hope, very sincere gratitude to you, Yoav, that we end this call. We will hold the collective minute of silence. Thank you, Aryeh, for the conversation and for facilitating the conversation. Thank you, Yoav, for your observation.
Shiv, I just have to thank you and the Awaken people are just it's been a wonderful opportunity to share with you, and I really appreciate your generosity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shiv. Thank you, Yoav.
Thank you so much. Yeah. We'll hold a collective minute of silence in gratitude. And after the silence, we'll open up the lines and do a gratitude out loud together. But first, let's do a minute of gratitude. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Aryeh. Thank you, Yoav. And
thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.